Can well-planned gardens transform how people feel about the city they live in and even how they treat each other? Lyndon Miller thinks so. Ms. Miller, a public garden designer, was the force behind the transformation of Central Park's Conservancy Garden in the early 1980s, and she used horticultural design to help reclaim a number of parks, Bryant Park and Madison Square Park among them, for public use and enjoyment in the years that followed. Her book, Parks, Plants, and People, has become something of a handbook for urban horticulturalists, planners, and community leaders since it was published by Norton last year, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
People who've moved to New York City during the last 15 or 20 years or who have grown up here recently may not realize just how dramatically Central Park and Bryant Park have changed. Will you tell us a bit about what those parks looked like in the early 1980s?
Oh, my. It was really awful. It came because of the fiscal crisis of that time, and the city cut all the maintenance funds for parks, and so the parks fell into terrible disrepair. Central Park, for instance, I have amazing pictures of the great lawn with graffiti and broken bottles and trash everywhere. The city streets were in very bad shape, and it was very demoralizing for people. Visitors noticed it a lot.
You agreed not only to take charge of restoring the 6-acre conservancy garden at 105th Street in Central Park, but also to raise the money needed to do the work, because it wasn't going to come from public funds?
Well, no. What happened was that when Central Park was first, in 1980, when Betsy Rogers formed the Central Park Conservancy, that was a unique public-private partnership designed to put private funds into the park because there simply wasn't enough. The Parks Department couldn't handle it. And so the conservatory garden was part of that, but 2 years later. And so I was told by Betsy that I needed to restore it and that I would have to raise all the money, and I couldn't use any of her donors, and I must bring the people back, which was quite a tall order.
And how long before you were able to pull it all together?
Well, she sent me up to look at it in September of 1982, and I went in, a nice young Parks Department employee who's still a colleague of mine took me around because it looked very sinister and dangerous, and people avoided it. And the same thing, of course, was happening all over the park. But this was in the northern end.
In Harlem. And
in Harlem.
There was a debate over it, and I'm assuming that the fact that the garden is in Harlem affected the tone of the debate.
Well, there was much, as I went out to try to raise the money, because I had to figure out how to do it, and I did it the old-fashioned way, which was going to friends and asking friends to take me to their friends. People would say, sure, it's a lovely old place. We'll give you $25 or something, but you're crazy because you can't do anything up there. If you remember, in the 80s, early 80s, the city was very polarized socially, racially, economically. And in fact, in the New York Times, I went in September of 82 and fell in love with the place and decided to try to do it. In the spring of 83, we were able to take all the plants out and start replanting. And at that time, there was an article in the Times listing the conservatory garden as one of the two places most avoided in Central Park and listing 96th Street as the demilitarized zone.
Now it's a very popular place and the site of the annual hat party.
Yes. Oh, that amazing hat party. That raises over $2 million for horticulture in Central Park.
Now, you didn't study garden design, did you?
I did.
I thought you were a landscape painter.
I was. I did abstract landscape, big, huge collages and small ones, too, of using Central Park, but they were abstracted. I loved Central Park and spent a lot of time walking around with Betsy Rogers talking about what could be done. But I had also taken 2 years of courses at the New York Botanical Garden in landscape design, and then I spent 2 wonderful years in England when my husband had a job there, going to every garden I could get my hands on.
I'm sure you were inspired by the gardens you saw in England, which are often beautiful. They're wonderful in France and Italy.
They are.
You would have thought with all of the people who've come from those countries to America that we would have seen more of their impact.
Oh, I think we did amongst people who had great estates. And, of course, Olmsted was the one who, in a sense, started everything in the 1850s because he was the one who started talking about how making beautiful parks in the city would change city life. And then there were people who had great estates, and they were certainly influenced by that. The Conservatory Garden itself, in fact, was an early WPA project, one of the projects under Moses, who's not one of my favorite people, but who did do that. And it was designed to be like an estate garden that was out on Westchester, in Westchester or Long Island.
Well, Olmsted, Frederick Law Olmsted, and Calvin Vaux, who designed Central Park and Prospect Park, felt that parks were a democratizing force.
Yes.
And they had become less of that, hadn't they? I mean, their idea was that the rich and the poor would meet in our public parks.
Well, I think that was the case as long as they were kept up. But what happened was that when they started not having funds, and that happened a number of times before the crisis of the early 80s, and they would be fixed up and then they would go downhill again, I think that's when they stopped being democratized, because people who could stayed away, and then the bad guys got in control.
Do you think the botanical gardens took the place of the parks to some degree? Even during the worst times, I remember Brooklyn Botanic Gardens was always filled with families, especially during the cherry blossom season, some of the other seasons.
Yes.
That are so important to cultures around the world.
Well, that's true. And, of course, the cemeteries originally were, in fact, America's parks. But the New York Botanical Garden, where I've been working for 25 years, given that it was in the Bronx, that already had a bad reputation. And so it wasn't until the late 80s that we really started turning that place around. And now, yes, it is really well visited.
You write about how New Yorkers flocked to public parks in great numbers on September 11th.
They did.
After the attack on the World Trade Center. Why do you think they did that?
I think people feel safe when there's a connection with nature. And this is what I've based everything I've done on, because from everything I read and the studies and going back to Olmsted and other people, human beings really have an innate need to be have a connection with nature. And that particular day, I walked up to the Conservatory Garden, which is not far from me, and I found people saying to me, oh, thank goodness this place is still here. It gives us the hope that life would go on. And that was the case with parks all over the city.
My guest is Lyndon B. Miller, whose book, Parks, Plants, and People, Beautifying the Urban Landscape, is published by Norton. Although these public parks once were funded exclusively by public money, as you point out, now they're, in recent years, they've been paid for by public and private partnerships, even by private developers. And you've included a chapter in your book about private funding for public parks. Are there any drawbacks to using private money to restore public parks?
Yes, there are. I think that what we have to be cautious of is that the people who the private funding doesn't come in and start making demands on the public space. That, and also another drawback is that the city itself, and not just New York, this is, I've been all over the country, that the city doesn't say, oh, okay, forget that. We don't have to look after the parks because the rich people will take care of them. I wish it were developers more often, because it's in the developers' good interest to take care of parks.
There's another argument. Jeffrey Croft of a group called NYC Park Advocates argues that New York has created a two-tier park system, one for the rich and one for the poor. He points out that Madison Square Park, which is just 6 acres, has 28 maintenance staffers, but there's only one worker in all of the 1,200 acres of parks in Canarsie and the Flatlands, poorer areas.
Well, this is true. Madison Square Park, where I did the landscape, is funded a lot by private money. It also has many ways of raising money, such as the Shake Shack, the most popular hot dog in anywhere that you can imagine. And it's true that the Parks Department has less private money to depend on in the other boroughs. And I've been chairman of something called New Yorkers for Parks for many years, and we have tried very hard to work with the Parks Department to find ways to either start business improvement districts or park improvement districts or friends groups to try to help those other parks.
How is the line drawn between what the city pays for and what the private partner or privately funded conservancy or alliance pays for, especially in terms of maintenance?
Yeah, I think that it depends. It varies from one to the other. But just that makes me want to go back and explain to people that there's two kinds of public funding. One is capital funding, which the Parks Department and other agencies have lots of. It allows them to restore a park. The other funding is called operational funding, and that is only for the maintenance of those places, and that's what the Parks Department doesn't have a lot of, and that's what they often have to depend on private entities for. But certainly in the case of Central Park, the proportion of private monies going into Central Park is huge compared to the public. On the other hand, that does allow the Parks Department to take some of their staff and funding and put it into other parks.
Well, I've spoken to people who say that they won't contribute money to nonprofit parks organizations because they believe it's the city's responsibility to collect the trash and mow the grass.
But
do they have a point?
Well, I suppose if you thought that was all that parks needed, but that isn't all that parks need. Parks need, in my view, horticulture for the year round. It needs people who know the people who come and speak to them. It needs benches. It needs sometimes food available. A park is a really living and exciting public entity.
Don't some cities make more of a commitment than others?
Chicago, for example.
And people in Chicago, some people complain that more money goes to making certain streets look gorgeous, and they do look gorgeous, than to the schools or the libraries or some of the other things that need funding. But it does make you feel wonderful when you walk down those streets with all those wonderful flowers.
Doesn't it? I think the case can be made that when you make the city look better, you attract more business, and therefore you attract more economic. I mean, people in Chicago are moving into the city. That brings the tax base up. They're not moving out. It's true that some people could argue that it's a kind of a frill, but Chicago is such an exciting place to live. Also, Mayor Daley himself told me this wonderful story. When he redoes an entire long boulevard or something with median strips, he doesn't start in the middle or at the rich end down by the lake. He starts at both ends of the thing, in the poor and the rich, and moves towards the middle because he doesn't want that to happen. He doesn't want them to run out of money when they get to the poorer parts.
So do you think that we could find ways to do that on some of our streets anyway? Park Avenue lends itself to it, but that is a street for the wealthy.
True, but I did a little park between 96th and 97th Street above that previously called demilitarized zone. And the Parks Department designed it, and I planted it. And it's now full of people and is making its usual effect on the surrounding neighborhood, helping the businesses, restaurants opening. It's the economic benefits of a well taken care of, well-designed park for people is huge.
You've been a proponent of creating public gardens that provide year-round interest rather than only looking good in the spring and the summertime. Why do you believe it's so important to have gardens that are interesting year-round?
Well, who wants to look at an empty, miserable bed all winter long when, with a little thought and care, you could find evergreens, shrubs that look nice in the winter, like the oak-leaved hydrangea, which is my favorite, which looks nice in four seasons. There are a number of perennials that will look nice in the winter. It's a question of knowing that, and I have long lists in my book to give people ideas about that.
Well, weren't plants that were meant to provide interest during the winter that you installed at the Central Park Zoo and at Bryant Park removed by people who didn't understand or maybe agree with your concept?
Well, that isn't, of course, I mean, the maintenance of them and the future of them is so important. And it doesn't always happen that someone sees it the way you do. In Bryant Park, we certainly got the place started, and I was there for 10 years. Now, there are an awful lot of bulbs and annuals, and they tend to drive out the perennials, and the shrubs could be better pruned, but the place is so full of life and cheer, and there are wonderful planter boxes full of plants all year round. So it's made its huge mark as an exciting public space.
Well, there's been a debate over the years of who could even go to some of the parks. I remember previous parks commissioners were upset that we had concerts in Central Park or that people were just camping out on the Great Lawn. And that whole attitude seems to have changed. Do you think for the better?
Well, I think it's, again, back to, I'm kind of repetitive on this. When it looks nice, people behave differently. My motto is make it gorgeous and keep it that way, and they will help you. And people rise to the occasion. They hear this unspoken message that we've done this for you and you're worth it. And making the Great Lawn look spectacularly beautiful means that it's fabulous for people, what, 360 days a year. And so then when we have concerts there, the Conservancy is very careful about how the land is treated.
Where do community gardens fit into all of this?
Are they of your concern? I did not talk about them in the book because that's such another great, big, huge subject. But they are, of course, again, an amazing example of when you fix up something and have something live and green and in a neighborhood, it improves the neighborhood. And we've seen it happen over and over again.
But they became a subject of big debate during the Giuliani years. He wanted to close them down.
And fortunately, Bette Midler and the Council on the Environment and the Trust for Public Land, they all got together and they saved those places. And those places in poorer neighborhoods are sometimes the only park and connection with nature that they get.
We're going through another economic downturn. Has it been hard to get people to give to the park funds?
We haven't found it to be so, but we worry about it. People seem to love what they've got and they want more of it. And there are more friends groups opening, and they are even having some business improvement districts in places like, or friends groups like the Conservancy in Van Cortlandt Park. I'm hoping that the bar has been set high enough that people will just say, hey, wait a minute. We care about that. That makes us enjoy living in this city more.
Do other cities deal with their parks in the same way? A few cities have parks of the grandness of, we have a great park in every borough.
We
have Central Park, Prospect Park.
We have 28,000 acres of parks in New York, and 1,700 of those are parks. And so we have this huge, huge number, and we spend about a quarter of a 1% of the huge budget on those parks. But other cities work in different ways. Vancouver is a city, for instance, that gives a great deal of money to the maintenance of their parks. Portland, Oregon does. Tupelo, Mississippi is starting to try to do this. Richmond is talking about it. I talk all over the country. And there, Wilmington has a big beautification operation.
Have you been hearing back from politicians as a result of this book? Do you think you've changed some minds?
Well, I hope so, but I don't see this as being read much by politicians. What I'm hoping is that this will be read by people who will then go to their politicians and say, hey, this is important. I hope this will be read by landscape architects and designers and architects who will help developers to put their money into beautification, and then the developers, of course, will reap money. Bryant Park, we did a study in 1999 at New Yorkers for Parks on the real estate values. And from the day it opened in 92 to 99, the real estate values went up 225%. And that's because it looked good.
Bryant Park was kind of depressing to go to for many
years.
Depressing,
and it was dangerous, too.
And now it's one of the more popular parks. Are credited with having taken almost all of the gorgeous photographs in this book as well.
Most of them, yes. I'm being a painter. I sort of have my clippers in one hand and my camera in the other because I lecture all the time. And so then when I started doing this book with Norton, which was so much fun and so much work, I discovered that many times I had the example myself that I wanted to show.
You'd already taken
I'd already taken it, yeah. Befores and afters are very important.
Well, the cover of the book looks like something that an impressionist might have painted.
Well, I'm a painter.
It looks like a Monet to me.
But that's the conservatory garden on a summer's day.
I remember the first time I went to the areas that the impressionists painted in, and I was stunned that they looked just as beautiful as the paintings. Because at that time, New York didn't have much of that.
No.
And now we do have any number of places that we can feel very proud of.
Oh, yes, and that changed the way people feel and make them feel good about themselves and their city. One young woman told me once that she was going to leave New York, and someone told her about the conservatory garden, and she came up and she said to me, a city that has a place like this, I'm not going. But also in the conservatory garden, there are these fabulous crabapple trees. They're 75 years old. And I joke that if Van Gogh has seen those, he wouldn't have had to go to Arles.
Didn't you do a lot of hands-on work on these gardens yourself?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I did.
You can't just say to people, okay, put that plant over there and put that other one over there.
I did a lot of that, but I trained the gardeners. I helped hire them. I helped get them better salaries. And so most of them I work very closely with, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, was to try to talk about what could be done and how to do it.
Are there new people coming along who will continue doing this kind of work?
Well, we're all looking for them, and we're hoping, because the New York Botanical Garden has a great school of professional horticulture. Longwood has one. And I'm always on the lookout for younger people who will come along and take over from me.
Meanwhile, we have we have our parks really improved, and we have this beautiful book which gives us an idea of just how we should maintain them and how we could probably make them even better, from Lyndon B. Miller, who has played such an important role in beautifying parks around the city. The book, Parks, Plants, and People, Beautifying the Urban Landscape. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.